As we just heard, President-elect Obama's energy plan could begin with you, and that includes your television. Next Monday, we'll take you shopping for an energy-efficient TV. It's part of our new weekly technology segment, All Tech Considered.
The segment isn't just for you, it's about you. That's why we need your help. If you have tech questions or story ideas, we'd like to hear them. You can go to npr.org/alltech and join the conversation.
In this part of the program, we hear about harnessing the energy of enthusiastic political supporters. In a moment, a comedian's take. First, here's NPR's national political correspondent, Mara Liasson, on Barack Obama's big new grassroots movement, those millions of volunteers and small donors who helped him beat John McCain. The president-elect has to figure out how they can help him govern.
On election night, a victorious Barack Obama thanked his wife and his campaign manager and his strategist, but then he thanked his volunteers, the army of political foot soldiers who donated money and knocked on doors.
This is your victory. Now, I know you didn't do this just to win an election. I know you didn't do it for me.
Now the incoming president has to be just as innovative in harnessing their power post-election as he was during the campaign. Howard Dean is the outgoing chairman of the DNC, and he's thrilled Obama has brought millions of new people into the Democratic Party.
He's changed all the rules, not just with the use of the internet and the fundraising, but he's changed the rules in terms of how you ask people for their vote and who you ask for your vote.
Obama took the foundation Dean himself dug in 2004 with his small-dollar internet fundraising and at the DNC with his now-vindicated 50-state strategy. And on top of all that, Obama erected a powerful political infrastructure. The numbers are eye-popping. 10 million names on an email list, 3.1 million donors. But the most important number of all may be the tens of thousands of what the campaign called super volunteers, people who worked sometimes 40 or 50 hours a week for Obama.
We've run sort of a giant experiment here in volunteer management, and we want to take a look at the lessons learned from that.
John Carson was the national field director for the Obama campaign, and he's one of the people trying to figure out what to do with the grassroots movement Obama created.
As President-elect Obama takes office and a legislative agenda is put together, I think in the same way that these incredible volunteers that we had carried his message throughout the campaign, talking to their neighbors about why he was the right candidate to bring the change that we needed, I can see them in a similar way explaining a health care proposal, explaining whatever issue it is.
And, of course, as soon as they're done explaining Obama's plans to their neighbors, President Obama can go right around the so-called media filter and urge them, through text messages and emails and video links, to inundate their Congress members with expressions of support for his agenda.
My name's Tony Lloyd, and I live in Racine, Wisconsin.
Meet one member of Obama's grassroots movement. Tony Lloyd used to live in Cedar Rapids, Iowa, where he first saw Obama and volunteered. Then his job took him to Wisconsin.
I went online again to, you know, sort of click the little volunteer button, and I went down to the local Barack Obama campaign headquarters and walked in and said, "What do you need me to do?"
Lloyd became an Obama team leader, getting out the vote. Since last Tuesday, he's remained plugged in to mybarackobama.com. And on Monday night, Lloyd himself created a new website, yeswecanracine.com. By Tuesday morning, it had 12 members.
There is an entire army out here who is anxious to continue to push in the same direction. And whatever he asks us to do, we will do. If he needs me to call my member of Congress, you know, I'm perfectly willing to do that. And the beauty of the web-enabled infrastructure that he built is the fact that it gives us all a way to be part of the conversation, both uploading our ideas and downloading from the Obama administration.
Lloyd's already been to the Obama transition website, change.gov. In keeping with the campaign's interactive approach, it asks visitors to share their memories of election night and their ideas for Obama's agenda. It's a way for the new administration to keep its supporters engaged until it knows what else it wants them to do. So if Howard Dean, with his millions of small donors, was Orville Wright, and Obama, with his wired grassroots, was Neil Armstrong, what will be next? Sarah Taylor is the former political director of the Bush White House, and she has one idea.
We're at a place in the country where almost everybody has a cell phone, but not many people have a smartphone, meaning a video-enabled phone. That'll change over the next 3 to 4 or 5 years.
And by then, Taylor says, if you're a mom with two kids who cares about education,
a smart, forward-leaning campaign will know that. They will have had you sign up into their system, and they'll be able to serve you advertising via a text message that links right to a video with your candidate speaking in a beautiful video about the importance of education reform. That, I think, is most likely to be sort of the next iteration of new technology.
It's a lot cheaper than buying television ad time, and it's just technology, available to any political party so long as it can harness it to serve a powerful message and a messenger, just like Barack Obama did. Mara Liasson, NPR News, Washington.
Good morning, I'm Renee Montaigne. Digital TV will come a month early to much of Hawaii on the wings of a bird. That's because the regular date to switch to digital, February 17th, is right at the beginning of the nesting season for the endangered Hawaiian petrel. And the petrel nests along the slopes of a volcano in Maui, where transmission towers now stand. Tearing the towers down would disturb the birds, so Hawaii is going digital in January.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Melissa Block.
And I'm Robert Siegel. Twitter, WiMAX, cloud computing, the dizzying language of technology. By the time we figure out how to speak the language, the tech world has moved on to something new. And to help you keep pace, we are launching a new weekly segment. It's called All Tech Considered. From software to social networks, from hybrids to high-def TVs. On Mondays, we'll explore new technologies and how they're changing the way we live.
Today, we start with your cell phone. A host of new phones, including the Apple iPhone and the T-Mobile G1, allow you to do more than just call your friends. You can go bowling without picking up a ball, find a nearby restaurant. You can even find your way home. It's all thanks to innovative new cell phone applications.
In a moment, we'll meet the designer of one of these new applications. But first, I've got a few different cell phones here in the studio, and I've got the one guy who knows how to work them, our tech guru, Omar Gayaga. Hi, Omar.
Hi, thanks for having me.
And Omar, first of all, what exactly is a cell phone application?
Well, in much the same way that on a desktop computer you might go to the store and purchase a box of software that you would bring home and install, it's kind of the same principle, but on a cell phone you can actually download it and you've got it right there on your phone instantly.
We'll begin. You're going to demonstrate an application. It's a camera application for a cell phone that is called Shop Savvy.
Yeah, one of the kind of killer apps so far for the T-Mobile G1 phone is called Shop Savvy, and what it does is it uses the built-in camera phone to barcode scan. Check this out.
We're going to take a picture with our cell phone camera now of a barcode.
Now, I've got a copy here of Scott Simon's book, Pretty Birds.
Pretty Birds. That's a novel by my friend and colleague, Scott Simon.
It recognizes the barcode.
So now you've taken a picture of the barcode on a product. It happens to be Scott's. There it is.
37 cents is the best price for a used copy on Amazon.com.
That's not going to pay Elisa's tuition, but it's it's found. You could hold this up in a store. You could go shopping, point the camera at barcodes, and it'll tell you you could actually get this somewhere else for a lot less.
Books, DVDs. Yesterday we scanned a bottle of Snapple, and it recognized the flavor. So, yeah, you can scan as you're shopping, get comparison prices, read reviews from people that have purchased the product. So you're getting quite a bit of information right there in the palm of your hand.
Okay, I'm wowed. I'm very impressed, although I feel badly for Scott. We'll move on to music right now.
Right. One of the applications that is on both the T-Mobile phone and also on the iPhone and that has been popular in England for a while is called Shazam. So if you hear a song on the radio that you don't recognize or in a movie and
you hold your phone up to it,
you
listen, your phone listens to the music, and it tells you where you could buy that music.
Exactly. It recognizes what Shazam calls a digital fingerprint and will spit back that information to you.
Show me.
Okay.
All right.
And what Shazam will do is it's going to what it calls tag the music.
You're just listening with the phone in your hand to what's playing out of the other cell phone. And it now has a screen up which says The Who, Baba O'Reilly, and it tells you what the album is. And I guess you could go from here to some website where they'd sell you the music.
To iTunes, I believe, and Amazon MP3, where you could download the song and you have it right there in your hands. And this works. You're in the car and you hear something on the car radio or in a movie, in a bar. It actually is able to kind of cut through ambient noise to recognize the song.
You have to be listening to an actual recording of that piece of music, because what the database is not all the music in the world, but all of these embedded codes that are inside the digital recording of the music.
Right. You can't sing to it or use it at a concert. It won't recognize it unless it's a recording.
Well, who needs it then? No, it's very impressive that you can do that, and that's called?
Shazam.
Shazam. Well, Omar, cool.
They're very cool.
It's Omar Gayaga, our tech guru from the Austin American Statesman. Thanks a lot, Omar.
Thank you so much, Robert.
Since the iPhone opened up to software makers in June, over 6,000 applications have been written for it, many of them games. NPR's Laura Seidel introduces us to one developer called Next Generation Mobile Company, or NG Moco.
For 11 years, Neil Young was a high-ranking executive at one of the largest game makers, Electronic Arts. So, why did he leave a nice, secure job to create a startup that makes games for the iPhone?
Temporary insanity.
You might think so, looking around his Spartan offices in downtown San Francisco. But Young jumped at the opportunity to design games for the iPhone.
It's how I imagine the record business must have been in the late 60s, early 70s.
They would go into a studio, lay down some tracks, and quickly send it out to radio stations.
You know, we're in the infancy of not just a revolution in mobile game design and play, but in sort of personal game design and play. The ability for a really, really broad audience to start interacting with, you know, with games in a way that they just haven't done before.
Young takes out his iPhone to play Rolando.
So I'm going to make him jump there. Oh, little bit. I lost one.
As the name implies, there is a lot of rolling around in this game. It's a world of cute, round creatures who are under attack by darkness. By tilting the iPhone, you roll them through a landscape of hills, mountains, houses. When they hit a river, you can drag a finger across the screen to draw a bridge.
Their deity is the finger, which is the player. You know, so they sort of speak to you and say, finger, finger, help us.
The opportunity to use all the iPhone has to offer, from size to connectivity, is part of what drew Bob Stevenson, the company's chief creative officer, into iPhone game development.
It's the ability to be able to make maybe 15 things at once and be just incredibly creative. And so it's kind of like a renaissance kind of area for being a game maker.
Stevenson says it costs so much more to make games for consoles, and it can take years. NG Moco has already released two games since its founding in July. One of them, called Maze Finger, has been downloaded over a million times. As the name implies, you use your finger to trace your way through a maze. If you go really quickly, it tells you that you're awesome. Stevenson and Young see so many new possibilities because the iPhone is portable and connected. Like, what about virtual pets?
You ever see those people that take their parrots and have their parrots on their shoulder all the time? You could have a parrot in your pocket. Let's do it. Let's make it. Parrot in the pocket.
That might not be such a far-fetched idea. One of the most popular downloads is Face Melter, which is just what it sounds like. It will take pictures of the faces of your family and friends and melt them. Laura Seidel, NPR News, San Francisco.
To see the Rolando application in action, go to our website, npr.org/alltech. And this new weekly segment isn't just about you listening to us. It's also about us listening to you.
Whether you're considering throwing your computer out the window or throwing yourself into the world of online dating, we want to hear your technology questions. They just might end up on the air. Visit npr.org/alltech. Then post your questions or suggestions for future segments on our discussion boards. We'll be listening, reading, and even posting ourselves. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
During his campaign, President-elect Obama staked out a clear position on many issues related to technology.
Together, we harness technology to confront the biggest challenges that America faces. Just imagine what we could do.
And now that he's in a better position to implement those ideas, we called in Morning Edition's technology commentator Mario Armstrong to talk about them. Morning, Mario.
Hi, Renee. How are you?
Fine, thank you very much. Barack Obama has appointed a technology expert to his transition team, and he said he plans to create a chief technology officer. How big a deal is this? And I mean, what would a technology czar do?
Number one, currently right now, chief information officers are at various agencies. So they need to centralize that effort and to make sure that all of the agencies are utilizing the best of breed of technology. So number two, they plan to work with private tech firms and import the best applications to run federal government. And thirdly, this tech czar would also be responsible to helping the government, the federal government, be more transparent and be more open in its processes and policies and decision making.
And here's a clip from a speech he gave to Google.
We will put government data online in universally accessible formats. I'll let citizens track federal grants, contracts, earmarks, and lobbying contracts.
And what else is he proposing to do in this area?
Well, you know, it's interesting because he teamed up with Republican Tom Coburn to create this Google-ish type of search engine that citizens would be able to search government contracts. So he has kind of proven that he's willing to take that step in this direction. And I think he has to follow up with how he's ran an election to now how he would transparently run government.
And here's another moment where he says he wants to improve access to the Internet.
I will set a goal of ensuring that every American has broadband access, no matter where you live, no matter how much money you have or don't have.
Mario, broadband is pretty accessible right now. So what else is he planning for high-speed internet service?
Well, some people would argue the point that it is not as accessible as you may think. The bottom line is the United States invented the internet. But now we rank around 14th, according to the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development. I mean, look at France. France is half the price of what we charge, and it's four times as fast. And Barack's position on this has been to utilize what is called the Universal Service Fund, which has typically been utilized to help rural America be able to receive phone service. They want to rewrite that to now go from phone service to broadband service.
As a candidate, Barack Obama took a position on the number of people allowed in under the H-1B visa program.
Yeah, absolutely. And this gets right to the heart of another issue. I mean, we're talking about immigration. A lot of tech companies and CEOs that need to have skilled engineers, skilled programmers, skilled technology workforce now favor the H-1B visa program. Barack Obama supports a temporary increase in skilled immigrants allowed here under the H-1B visas. But really what I've been hearing is that what he wants to do is to have a comprehensive immigration reform policy. And H-1B visa would be a part of that. While they are working on that longer piece, he is supportive of a temporary increase with the H-1B visas. So now you have all of these issues, economy, education, entrepreneurship, innovation. I mean, and this is just, I guess this is just my personal opinion. Technology is usually seen as a spoke in the wheel, and now it's the hub that's working within all of these spokes.
Mario Armstrong is Morning Edition's regular technology commentator. He also hosts a radio show called The Digital Cafe, which is on Baltimore Public Radio Station WEAA. Glad to talk with you again.
Thank you, Renee. Appreciate it.